longer nourished appropriately. Drinking large amounts in one sitting, even on rare occasions, can affect the electrical system that regulates your heartbeat. Your heart may not beat hard enough, which can cause your blood to pool and clots to form. The opposite can also happen. Your heart can beat too fast, which doesn't allow for the chambers to fill with blood. In turn, an insufficient amount of oxygen pumps out into your body, and as a result, binge drinking raises your likelihood of having a stroke by 39%. Your blood vessels are stretchy, like elastic, so that they can transport blood without putting too much pressure on your heart. And drinking alcohol releases stress hormones that constrict your blood vessels, elevate your blood pressure, and cause hypertension, in which the blood vessels lose that elasticity. Your liver. 2 million Americans suffer from alcohol-related liver disease, making it a leading cause of illness and death. Your liver stores nutrients and energy and produces enzymes that stave off disease and rid your body of dangerous substances, including alcohol. When your liver metabolizes alcohol, it creates toxins which are actually more dangerous than the alcohol itself. Alcohol damages liver cells by causing inflammation, and it weakens your body's natural defenses. Liver inflammation disrupts your metabolism, which impacts the function of all other organs. Further, inflammation can cause liver scar tissue to build up. Simultaneously, your liver function suffers because alcohol alters the natural chemicals in the liver needed to break down and remove that scar tissue. Drinking also causes steatosis, or fatty liver. Fat buildup on your liver makes it harder for the liver to operate. And eventually, fibrosis, some scar tissue, becomes cirrhosis, much more scar tissue. Cirrhosis prevents the liver from performing critical functions, including managing infections, absorbing nutrients, and removing toxins from the blood. This can result in liver cancer and type 2 diabetes. And 25% of heavy drinkers will develop cirrhosis. Your immune system. Germs surround us, making our immune system our most important tool for fighting off disease. Our skin is the first line of defense against infection and disease. But if germs do make it into the body, we have two systems that provide defense. The innate system, which fends off first-time germ exposure, and the adaptive system, which retains information about prior germ invasions and promptly defeats repeat attackers. Alcohol suppresses both systems. Our immune system uses small proteins called cytokines to send out chemical messages about infection in a kind of early alert system. Alcohol disrupts the production of cytokines. When working correctly, cytokines alert our immune system to intruders, and our immune system responds with white blood cells that attack, surrounding and swallowing harmful bacteria. Alcohol impairs both functions, leaving us more susceptible to pneumonia, tuberculosis, and other diseases. Further studies link alcohol to an increased susceptibility to HIV, not only increasing our chances of contracting HIV, but also impacting how rapidly the disease develops once contracted. Alcohol and cancer. Occasional drinking couldn't possibly cause cancer, could it? Yes, apparently it does. In a meta-analysis of 222 studies across 92,000 light drinkers and 60,000 non-drinkers with cancer, light drinking was associated with higher risks for many types of cancers, including breast cancer. A 7-year study of 1.2 million middle-aged women highlights the direct and terrifying link between drinking and cancer. According to this study, alcohol increased the chance of developing cancers to the breast, mouth, throat, rectum, liver, and esophagus. The most frightening revelation is that the cancer risk increases no matter how little the women drank. According to the National Cancer Institute, the risk of breast cancer was higher across all levels of alcohol intake. And according to Cancer Research UK, quote, there is no safe limit for alcohol when it comes to cancer, end quote. It also doesn't matter what type of alcohol you drink. It's the alcohol itself that leads to the damage, regardless of whether you imbibe on beer, wine, or hard liquor. And although many of us are not aware of the relationship between alcohol and cancer, it again should not come as a surprise. Alcohol was officially declared a carcinogen in 1988. And alcohol itself, ethanol, is a known carcinogen. And alcoholic beverages can contain at least 15 other carcinogenic compounds, again including arsenic, formaldehyde, and lead. Alcohol causes or contributes to cancer in different ways. When your liver breaks down alcohol, it produces a toxic chemical called acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde damages your cells, rendering them incapable of repair and making them more vulnerable to cancer. Cirrhosis also leads to cancer. Alcohol increases some hormones, including estrogen, contributing to a breast cancer risk. It also causes cancer by damaging DNA and stopping our cells from repairing this damage. In summary, any level of alcohol consumption increases the risk of developing an alcohol-related cancer. And I know this is a discouraging message. The good news is that even though there's no safe level of drinking when it comes to cancer, studies show that a reduction in intake, or even better, stopping altogether, immediately lowers your cancer risk. Alcohol and death. You probably already know that you can die from alcohol poisoning by drinking too much in a single sitting. What you may not know is that an alcohol overdose can also occur from continual infusion of alcohol into the bloodstream over time, resulting in death that does not correlate with a single binge. Early death from alcohol steals more than 2.4 million hours of human life per year in the United States. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, alcoholism reduces life expectancy by 10 to 12 years. This information may lead you to ask what level of alcohol use is safe. According to the most up-to-date research in 2018, there is no risk-free level of alcohol consumption. In fact, alcohol use is the leading risk factor for death among people 15 to 49 years old, and the seventh leading risk factor for death among all ages. The most recent and most comprehensive study says that, quote, the level of consumption that minimizes health loss is zero. Considering how many people drink every day, this is a sobering fact indeed. Today, I want you to give your body a big thank you and decide whether that glass of wine or pitcher of beer is worth all the health risks that you now know about. Once you learn these risks, you just can't unlearn them. Day 23, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. In your own words. Today's only journal reflection is for you to tell yourself what you've learned in this chapter. I want you to anchor it in. I know it might feel like you're just repeating what you just heard, but it's vital for the subconscious to truly understand and for your actual desire to have a drink to change. So simply write down what you learned about alcohol and your health, in your own words. Go into as much detail as possible, and don't underestimate the power of this seemingly simple exercise. Day 23, reflections from alcoholexperiment.com. Miranda says, so interesting that health was the topic of today's reading. I went to the doctor today and my blood pressure was in the ideal range. When I was drinking, my blood pressure was borderline high, or outright high, and my previous doctor wanted me on blood pressure meds. I have also lost 3 pounds in the 25 days I've been free from alcohol. Rusty said, "When I was drinking, I didn't want to know about the harmful effects of alcohol. I wouldn't read or listen to any reports about it. I knew it wasn't good for me, especially since I'm a cancer survivor, but I wasn't ready or willing to give it up. Now I want to know all the negative effects. I want to know the truth, and it reinforces my desire to remain alcohol-free." Gail says, "I'm seeing drinkers as crazy people. I can't believe how much damage alcohol has caused my body, and I'm stunned that some of it contains formaldehyde, arsenic, and lead. How does the drinks industry get away with it? I just don't get it anymore." Act 10. Alcohol and Anger. Awareness. People tell me all the time that when they give up alcohol, everyone and everything seems to get on their nerves. For no reason at all. They just want to lash out at people. They're frustrated, impatient, and angry, and they don't get why that's the case. This is a real phenomenon, and I want you to understand where it comes from so you won't use it as a reason to keep drinking. So let's name this belief. Drinking helps me keep my cool. Clarity. It's pretty simple to understand where this belief comes from, because if you've ever tried to stop drinking in the past, you know that you do get short-tempered. It happens. And we've certainly witnessed people in movies and on TV getting angry whenever the character gives up any addictive substance, such as alcohol, cigarettes, or even sugar. It's easy to conclude that if quitting alcohol makes you angry, then drinking must somehow help out with anger. We assume that the alcohol must provide some sort of calming effect. Let's dig deeper into this one. You've been without alcohol in your system for a little while now, and you might be feeling on edge or short-tempered with people around you. It's not that you're always like this and the alcohol was calming you down. It's quite the opposite. You're experiencing withdrawal symptoms as the alcohol leaves your system. You've experienced this before, though you may not have realized it. Think back on the few times when you were short with people. Maybe these were moments of extreme anger or even violence, but you definitely regret your behavior. You weren't yourself. Take a moment to remember two or three of those episodes, and notice where alcohol fit into the picture. Most likely, those bouts of anger occurred a few hours to a few days after your last drink. Is that true for you? It's because, again, the alcohol was leaving your system. There's a well-documented link between aggression and alcohol consumption. Drinking is involved in about 75% of all child abuse deaths and half of all violent crimes. On college campuses, 95% of all violent crimes and 90% of sexual assaults involve alcohol. Why? What is it about alcohol that fuels all this anger and aggression? The biggest reason is that alcohol gives you tunnel vision. It narrows your focus so you can't or won't see extenuating circumstances. You're unable to accept any alternative points of view. Let's say you leave a sporting event and your team lost. Bummer. But you've been drinking and you're upset about it. As you're walking out of the crowded arena, someone in the opposing team's jersey bumps into you. Your perception is that he shoved you on purpose. He did it to rub it in. His team won and yours lost. And since your team lost, you feel like you lost. You're a loser. Had you been sober when that happened, you might have simply said, "Oh, sorry, it sure is crowded in here." When you're drunk, you lose your reasoning power, and you're far more likely to react with aggression. You lose the power to read social cues and behave appropriately. That simple bump could easily turn into a fist fight right there in the hallway. Chemically, as your blood alcohol content is falling, you experience a surge in stressors and stress hormones, such as adrenaline and cortisol. And adrenaline in particular is the hormone involved in the fight or flight response. When you're drinking, you're far more likely to choose the fight option. Aggression just seems like the right decision. And remember, alcohol also affects the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for helping us make good decisions. It's your brain's command center. The alcohol lulls that part of your brain to sleep, so you're less able to resist unwise behavior, like drunk texting your ex at 2 a.m. In addition to the physical changes happening in your body and your brain, there are social ramifications linking aggression and alcohol. Because so many people drink, we all understand what happens. We all know drinking makes us more aggressive and edgy. So we're more likely to forgive someone who snaps at their kid or gets into a fight when they've been drinking. We all know how a hangover feels. So we're more likely to cut our friends some slack when they're being short-tempered. Because we can always blame it on the alcohol. We're more likely to give in to our more aggressive impulses. So why do these feelings continue after we're no longer consuming alcohol? Remember that it takes about a week for the chemicals to stop affecting your body and brain. It takes time for the toxins to completely leave your system. That withdrawal process doesn't feel good, and it's only natural that you're on edge for a while. So give yourself a break. Be gentle and let the cleansing happen. It could even be a good time to take a few days away by yourself so you don't have to worry about hurting anyone you love. And there's something you should know about anger itself. You may not realize it, but anger is actually a secondary emotion. It shows up to mask another emotion, usually hurt or worry. If your children are misbehaving in a restaurant and you get angry at them, you might be feeling worried about what the other patrons are thinking. Or you might be feeling hurt that they're not listening to you. You're probably afraid that your child's misbehaving is an indication that you are somehow failing as a parent. It's an insecurity. Either way, you react with anger to cover up what you're actually feeling. Because anger, unlike pain or fear, is a socially acceptable emotion. Everyone gets it, especially other parents who have been there themselves. Once you're aware of this phenomenon, it's fascinating to catch yourself getting angry and then trying to figure out your feelings. You can use your anger as sort of a warning light to explore what you're feeling rather than masking it with alcohol. It takes courage, but you can step out of the moment and say, okay, I'm angry with the kids right now. What is it I'm afraid of? I'm scared that I'm screwing up as a parent. What if they never listen to me again? What if I can't ever get them to behave? If I were a better parent and not focused on my work so much, they would behave better. That's a lot of negativity. It's also a lot of weight to carry as a parent. Just being aware of it, though, can help you be kinder to yourself. Emotions can be powerful, but most of the time, they're not pointing to something that's truly wrong. The temptation is to go have a drink or chill out and handle the anger. But you know that's not going to solve anything. In fact, things will get worse. So here's a great way to handle your anger without alcohol. Change your physical state. Your mind and body work together to create all emotions, especially anger. If you disrupt that pattern by changing something physically, you can break anger's hold on you. Something as simple as a cold shower or getting exercise works wonders. Screaming into a pillow at the top of your lungs can also work great. Or doing some push-ups or jumping jacks or playing with the dog. Just get active. Another tool you can use to diffuse anger is to consciously try and get even more angry. I know this sounds weird, but when I tried it, it was like a miracle. Let's say there's an anger scale from 1 to 10. First, evaluate where you are. Maybe you're annoyed and feel like you're at a level 6. Your teeth are clenched, the adrenaline is surging, your blood is pounding in your ears. Okay, now try to make yourself even more angry. Try to level up to a 9 or a 10. And don't be surprised if you find yourself laughing. Because anger is a secondary emotion, it falls apart when you try to use it as a primary emotion. If you're trying to be angry, it doesn't actually work. The feeling just goes away. And finally, using mindfulness as a tool can help you try to cope with frustrating circumstances and everyday anger. You don't have to sit and meditate on a cushion for 30 minutes a day, although if you want to, go for it. Mindfulness means becoming aware of your thoughts and feelings, consciously noticing when you're upset, and thinking about what's behind that upset. When practiced regularly, mindfulness gives you a bit of space in your brain from the time you're triggered and when you actually get angry. And even a fraction of a second is enough to help you get a handle on the things before you react badly. In that little bit of space, you can put other tools into action. It's important to realize that the irritability and stress you feel as the alcohol is leaving your system is temporary. I'm not saying you'll never get angry or lose your temper ever again, but the additional edgy feeling will subside. Turnaround. The opposite of drinking helps me keep my cool is drinking helps me lose my cool, or alcohol makes me angry and irritable. Come up with as many ways as you can that the opposite is as true or truer than the original belief. Day 24. Are addictive personalities real? Norman Vincent Peale said, "Change your thoughts and change your world." Before we talk about addictive personalities, let's agree on a definition of addiction. For simplicity and for our purpose today, we can say that addiction is nothing more than doing something on a regular basis that we don't want to do. Notice that there's a conflict or disagreement in that sentence. We're doing it, but we don't want to be doing it. There's cognitive dissonance. Because the conflict is happening inside our minds, it's understandable that we might think an addictive personality is to blame. While it's true that some people fall into the addiction cycle quickly, and others never become dependent on alcohol, it's dangerous to use this term to describe people. Why? Because it puts the blame squarely on the shoulders of the individual. It makes them solely responsible for their addictive behavior, even though it's the substance that's addictive. The way alcohol reacts chemically with our bodies is how we become addicted. There's a whole host of factors involved, like age, weight, environment, culture, and yes, even personality. But the same personality traits that might contribute to an addiction can also be the way out. The way in is the way out. Take my case. I'm decisive. I have a strong will. I take commitments seriously. All those traits likely caused me to become addicted to alcohol. I was strongly committed to my decision to drink. However, once I decided to stop drinking, I was equally strong-willed and committed. The way in was also the way out. My father is the same way. He makes up his mind once and sticks with it. When he was drinking, that meant he had no cognitive dissonance around alcohol. He liked to drink, so he did. And those same traits made it easy for him to stop when the time came. Once he realized alcohol wasn't making him happy anymore, he just stopped without any problem. Take someone who goes along with the crowd and is easily influenced by others as another example. Environment plays a huge part in whether they become addicted to alcohol. If they hang out with heavy drinkers, chances are they'll become one too. In that case, their best hope might be to find a new crowd to hang out with, or at least one person who inspires them to enjoy activities without drinking. Same personality trait, two completely different outcomes. The idea of an addictive personality leaves the drinker with little hope. They might feel like, oh well, this is the personality I was born with. Might as well make the most out of being a drunk. When in fact, that person may have everything they need to overcome their addiction if they were able to take a different perspective. As a society, we revere alcohol, we love it, and we turn a blind eye to all the harm it causes. So by labeling a person as having an addictive personality, we're letting alcohol off the hook as the problem. And it also lets us off the hook. Other people might have a problem, but we're fine. and this can lead to an overconfidence with drinking and make us even more reckless. How many times have you seen someone drive home from a party when they should have called a cab? Chances are that their last words as they headed out the door were, "I'm fine." Let's hope they were. Today, think about whether you've considered yourself to have an addictive personality. Have you blamed yourself for that downward spiral and let alcohol off the hook for its part in the equation? Write down a list of your top three positive and negative personality traits. And be honest. No one is going to see this but you. Then, for each one, think about how that trait could lead you deeper into addiction and how it could lead you out of your drinking cycle. Don't judge yourself. Don't try to do anything with what you're writing. Just introduce a new idea and let your subconscious mind mull it over for a while. Day 24, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Your, quote, addictive personality. Have you considered yourself to have an addictive personality? Have you blamed yourself for that downward spiral and let alcohol off the hook for its part in the equation? How has that felt to you? How do you feel now with this newfound knowledge? 2. The best and worst of your personality. Now make a list and be honest. Write down a list of your top three positive and top three negative personality traits. 3. Now consider. For each trait you just listed, consider how that trait could lead you deeper into drinking more than you intended. And now consider how that very same personality trait might lead you out of the drinking cycle. Day 24 Reflections from AlcoholExperiment.com. Lindsay says, "Well, this is hard for me. I don't like to think of my negative personality characteristics because I don't want to own them. I'm strong like many others in this experiment. I like to do things myself, control issues. I'm loyal, kind, and forgiving, which has led me to forgive myself each morning and start each day fresh, only to drink again that night. It's so good for me to forgive myself, but I find myself wondering what I'll do once the 30 days are up." Marley says, "I can totally see why the traits I have can work for or against addiction. I can either spiral downward or climb upward. I say climb, which implies effort in this experience, but I really have not put forth much effort except to open my mind to this naked mind in the alcohol experiment. I feel now that my opened mind was ready and happy to receive this new info and way of thinking." And Bess says, "It's interesting that the same personality traits that can lead to the spiral down into addiction can also be helpful in finding the way out. One thing that is sticking with me is the fact that the only thing we have any control over is ourselves. If we can only change our own thoughts, behaviors, and wishes, we cannot change anyone else." Day 25. Setbacks and the way forward. Albert Einstein said, "You never fail until you stop trying." Occasionally, I get messages from people who have used my book, This Naked Mind, to stop drinking, and then, after a little while, have started again. Sometimes it's triggered by a traumatic event, like a death in the family. Sometimes it creeps up on them slowly. They figure they can handle themselves for one night, but then one night of drinking turns into a week, and then into a month. At some point, they recognize they're no longer in control. If you make a decision to stop drinking beyond this 30-day experiment and you end up slipping, it's important that you relax and don't beat yourself up. It doesn't mean that you're an incurable addict or a bad person, and it certainly doesn't mean that you're beyond hope. All it means is that you're human. People get to the end of the 30-day experiment and they're full of excitement. They feel empowered. like a light came on in their brains and they can suddenly see the truth. But we all live in the real world, and the real world is full of pro-drinking messages. Alcohol in advertising is everywhere. Our friends might pressure us to drink, even though they know we don't want to. You might think you're immune to this kind of pressure, but it can be relentless. Your perspective is forever changed. The beautiful thing is that by listening to the daily lessons and going through the exercises, you've learned a skill. You understand cognitive dissonance and how to resolve it without resorting to numbing out. You have the tools and you know how to use them. That's such good news. When I first started to question my drinking, it took almost a year of education and exploration before I finally resolved my dissonance for good. And for all I know, I may have to do it again in the future. At the moment, I don't feel like I'll ever touch another drink. I just don't have the desire for it anymore. But I'm well aware that no one is immune, and the desire could come back. I doubt it will, but if it does, I know what to do. Reframe mistakes as necessary experience. I live in Colorado, and we get a lot of snow in the winter. Driving on snow takes special skill. You need to turn on your four-wheel drive, you need to slow down and allow extra time to get to your destination. But sure as anything, when the first snowfall of the season hits, people drive like idiots. Because they've forgotten what it feels like to lose control of their vehicle, even for a few seconds. Cars and trucks slide off the road, and the night sky is lit up with red and blue lights from police cars trying to rescue stranded motorists. It's like everyone gets amnesia between April and October. Once the next snowfall comes, we remember, and we're more cautious. And we learn from our mistakes. Regaining control of your drinking might take a few tries. You might feel like you've got a handle on it, and then you're suddenly right back where you started. Don't blame yourself or beat yourself up. Forgive yourself and learn from the experience. Go back to your list from day one and say, okay, what needs to happen from here so I can regain control? I believe it gets easier every time you do it because your subconscious mind has more control over your behavior than alcohol now does. Every time you go back and repeat the abstinence period, you are subconsciously reinforcing your desire to stay in control. When your subconscious and your conscious mind are in harmony, you are back in the driver's seat. So today, remember that as long as you're alive, you will never run out of chances to regain control of your life. The only way to fail at this is to give up and stop trying. Day 25, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Consider, quote, failure. Think about the concept that the only way to fail at this is to stop trying. That as long as you approach setbacks with compassion and understanding and a renewed desire to find your personal freedom, there is no failure. What does this mean to you? What commitments are you willing to make to yourself to ensure that your, quote, failures become stepping stones to where you truly want to be? 2, a letter to your past self. Take some time and write a letter to your past self, the self that was nervous just before day one of the alcohol experiment. Talk about how you feel today, where your biggest aha moments have been, and what your hopes are for the future. Tell yourself anything you wish you would have known right before you started. And be honest, there's no right or wrong things to say. Day 25 Reflections from AlcoholExperiment.com. Kathleen says, "It's amazing how fast the time has gone. 25 days is just amazing to me. I did have 2 slips and really took stock in what my triggers are. I'm so grateful to learn so much about myself and proud that I can be in charge of my decisions. I continue to work on self-love every day, and I do have a lot of work to do. However, I truly believe the alcohol moved me right back to self-loathing. There's nothing fun about drinking for me. That didn't take long to realize. I see it more of a habitual ritual, which has to change for me to truly love myself and be my best me. Laura says, going alcohol-free is the tip of the iceberg to so many other life-changing positive ways. I had no idea this process would start a reinvention of my life. And Darby says, after 25 days on the program, I couldn't be happier. Last night, I went out with my wife, children, and grandchildren and in-laws for dinner. Wore my favorite pants that I haven't been able to fit in for 10 years. I looked better and felt great, and when asked what I wanted to drink, I just said I would have a Coke. My daughter said, "You look great, Dad," and that made me feel even better. People were drinking all around me, as it was a licensed venue, but I felt very strong, almost superior, and did not for one moment feel like an alcoholic drink. In the past, I may have felt pressured to have a drink, but I just don't care what other people think anymore. In the past, if I didn't have a drink, I would have a drink when I got home. Last night, came home, had an ice cream and herbal tea, and watched some TV, went to bed, slept well, and woke up early to go to the gym. That's my new life. Thanks, Annie. Day 26. Liberation versus fixation. T.F. Hodge says, freedom is realizing you have a choice. Sometimes it's hard to tell when alcohol is actually running the show. We tend to rationalize and feel like we're drinking in moderation, when in fact we're no longer in control of our actions. So I came up with a scale called liberation versus fixation to help me figure out whether or not I was in control. Liberation is when I can take the substance or leave it. I'm in control, and I'll have a great time whether or not I choose to drink. Fixation is when the cravings and addiction have taken hold, and I'm losing power over my own choices. Here are the clues that can help you decide where you are in terms of moderation. One of the most painful things for us as humans to feel is powerless. Ironically, we give our power away to alcohol without even realizing that it's happening. Today's ideas will help you recognize where you are inadvertently giving up your power to booze so that you can consciously decide to take it back. Liberation is being offered a beer and truly feeling like you could take it or leave it. Fixation is waiting to be offered a beer. It's walking into a party and wondering when somebody will offer you a beer. Liberation involves no internal dialogue. There's no other voice in your head arguing with you. Fixation is talking with yourself about whether you should drink, if you will feel bad in the morning. There's nonstop chatter around the substance. That chatter focuses your mind on the drink, making you want the substance even more. Liberation means you can have one drink and not give it another thought. You're perfectly content. Fixation means you're thinking about your next drink, often before the one in your hand is even finished. Liberation does not come with a jonesing for the substance after it leaves your system. Fixation often means withdrawal symptoms and cravings begin as soon as the substance begins to fade away. Someone who can handle themselves around chocolate can have just one bite, but someone who's addicted to chocolate has to finish the whole bar that's in front of them, and then strategizes on how to get more. Liberation puts the focus on the people and the environment. There's little to no focus on the substance. Fixation puts the focus on the drink, not the party, even if that focus is on how not to drink. Liberation lets you be around the substance without a problem. Fixation means you can't have it in the house without temptation. Liberation is rational. You can decide not to drink because you have to get up early in the morning. Fixation is irrational. Even though you have that early meeting, you still want to drink. Now, none of these ideas are universally true for every person. They're simply guidelines to give you perspective as to where you truly are in terms of moderation. If you find yourself fixating on alcohol and having internal conversations about it, then you're probably heading down that slippery slope and you might want to be extra careful. Today, define what moderation means to you. If you're aiming to be moderate in your drinking going forward, it's important to decide exactly what that means. Does it mean 2 drinks per week, or 2 drinks per month, or 1 drink every other weekend? Keep going and determine how you want to feel as you moderate. How much of a hangover is too much? Is it okay if you have a slight headache, but not okay if you're puking the next day? If you don't define what moderate means, you won't have any way of knowing when you've gone too far. In reality, you're going to want to define this as you go. Before you go to that party, decide you're going to have 1 drink and then stop. Before you head to that networking event, decide you're going to drink ginger ale instead of alcohol. And if you're going to drink whatever you want and not feel guilty about it, fine, but make that decision before you start drinking. And stick to the not feeling guilty part. Day 26, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Liberation versus fixation. Consider the day's teaching in your own life and write honestly about what your relationship with alcohol was before this experiment. Were you truly liberated in your choices, or were you fixated on alcohol to a point where your choices did not feel entirely like your own? 2. Your future. Based on the idea of liberation versus fixation, brainstorm at least 3 instances in your future that you will use as guideposts to determine if you're truly liberated or if you're fixated on drinking. Feel free to use some of the examples from this chapter, and if you come up with more than 3, that's even better. And remember, you don't necessarily have to be drinking to be fixated on alcohol. I've known sober people who are still, years later, fixated on alcohol. The goal here is to become hyper-aware of when and where you're fixated so that you can do the mental work, employing the ACT technique, to liberate yourself from your fixated thinking. Day 26, reflections from alcoholexperiment.com. Hillary said, "I have come to the realization that I will never be a moderate drinker, and I don't want to go back to the obsession that is fixation. When I hit day 30, no way do I even want to think about trying to moderate. It won't happen, and I will be back in hell in no time. No thanks." Patricia says, "I love moderation. I was in that group that was prevented from changing by the thought that I could never have a drink again. I'm using awareness and positive self-talk now to decide for myself when I want to drink, not just drinking out of habit or social circumstance." Ethan says, "I was definitely fixated on alcohol. It really occupied my thoughts for the past few years, if I'm honest about it. Learning skills in this experiment has been invaluable to me moving forward. The alcohol experiment has taught me how to change how I think about alcohol. I'm starting to venture out more and more, and as I do, I always visualize how the night is going to go when I'm getting ready. I throw on some good music while sipping a non-alcoholic beer and then see the night play out in my mind, how I want it to play out, how it will play out. I find practicing visualization gives me a little pep in my step, a bit of confidence. It's like I've been here before and I already know the ending. I choose it. It's freaking happening, and I'm really digging feeling this good." Day 27. Is alcohol really poisonous and addictive? Norman Vincent Peale says, "How you think about a problem is more important than the problem itself." Wow, you are nearly there. and I'm proud of you. I hope you're proud of yourself. Today I want to conduct a bit of a review and summarize a lot of what I've said about the nature of alcohol and how your body neurologically and physiologically reacts to it. It's interesting that our culture has completely obscured the fact that alcohol is poison to our bodies. Not only that, but it's an addictive poison. Before you decide whether you believe those two statements, please take a minute to hear the facts. Take off the blinders about whatever you feel alcohol to be, and let's look at the actual chemical composition of this controversial liquid. But before we discuss alcohol as an addictive substance, let's talk about what addiction actually is. It's nothing more than an up-and-down cycle. You consume something, sugar, drugs, alcohol, it doesn't matter, and you feel better temporarily. Then the feeling goes away. You want that feeling back, so you consume the same substance again. But this time, it doesn't feel quite as good as your subconscious mind remembers, so you need a little bit more. Then the effects wear off, and you consume it again. It's literally a high and low cycle that keeps you coming back to whatever substance you subconsciously believe makes you feel better. A closer look at the cycle. Now let's review how that happens with alcohol. Please understand, these are the chemical facts about how alcohol works in your brain and body. This isn't my opinion, it's fact. There are four types of alcohol: methyl, propyl, butyl, and ethanol. If you consume even tiny amounts of the first three types, you'll either go blind or die. They are extremely toxic. Ethanol is the only type of alcohol humans can consume without dying. However, it's still so toxic that if you take even just a sip or two of pure ethanol, you will instantly vomit the poison back out of your body. Ethanol is a general anesthetic. If you inject 2 or 3 milliliters of ethanol per kilogram of body weight, you will anesthetize the human body. That means you'll go completely unconscious. Ethanol was used as a general anesthetic in Mexico, London, and Germany in the 1929 through 31 era, but was abandoned because of its toxicity. When we drink, we're consuming pure ethanol in tiny amounts. A strong beer is about 6% alcohol by volume. Wine is generally 12 to 16% alcohol by volume. Even hard liquor is only 40% alcohol, and people usually add mixers, which dilute the percentage even more. We're masking the poisonous ethanol with a lot of other stuff that makes the drink taste better. But the anesthetic effects remain. Anesthetic and depressant. In addition to being an anesthetic, alcohol is a depressant. It depresses your feelings and your nervous system. Depending on how much pure alcohol you consume, you might pass out completely or just feel nicely numb for a while. But our brains react to stimuli, and they are designed to maintain balance or homeostasis. That means if you consume something that's an anesthetic and a depressant, it's automatically going to try to counteract those things with stimulants like cortisol and adrenaline. These stimulants leave you feeling anxious and uneasy, so you reach for that next drink to take away that uneasy feeling. And the brain fights back with even more of its own chemical stimulants. And the cycle starts. Let's say you had a hard day at work and you just want a drink. Happy hour it is. You head for your favorite watering hole and have a drink. Within a short time, everything slows down. The alcohol's natural depressants dull your senses, and you subconsciously interpret that as relaxation. You feel better for about 20 to 30 minutes. Then it's time for your brain to kick back into action and regain balance. There are depressants in your system, so your brain releases more stimulants to bring you back up. The problem is those stimulants make you even more uneasy and anxious than you were to start with. Well, one drink was good, so two must be better, right? So you have another drink in an effort to counteract the chemicals your brain released in an effort to counteract the alcohol. Confused? So is your body. It releases more stimulating stress hormones to battle that second drink. Back and forth. Depressants, stimulants, depressants, stimulants. This cycle might continue on and on until you pass out from the sheer amount of poisonous ethanol in your system. And thank goodness, because passing out gives your body a chance to metabolize the poison and detoxify your blood as best as it can. The downward cycle. Here's the interesting part, though. Every time you take another drink to counteract the stress hormones, you return to a level that's below where you were just 30 minutes earlier. Imagine a feel-good scale from 1 to 10, with 10 being that you feel amazing. Then imagine you head into happy hour at about 6. It's been a hard day, but you got through it, and you know a drink will get you to a 9 or a 10. After your brain counteracts that first drink, the second one might bounce you back to only a 7 or 8, but then your brain will bring you back down. And you might try to bounce back, but this third time you only make it to a 5, lower than you started off the night. Chemically, you're fighting a losing battle. Or maybe it's actually a winning battle because your brain will do everything in its power to keep you from actually dying. So why don't we recognize alcohol as an addictive substance like cocaine or heroin? It's the same high-low cycle in our bodies, so what's the deal? I think it has to do with time. Drugs like heroin are metabolized quickly, especially if they're injected directly into the bloodstream. It doesn't take long for numbing and that high to take effect. And it's easier to see that the next hit needs to be more powerful than the last one for you to get the same high. But alcohol is different. It enters the bloodstream more slowly. We only notice that drink makes us feel better because that's what happens first. We don't notice the slow decline as those stimulant hormones take effect. We pay attention only to the climb, not the fall. So our subconscious minds learn that alcohol lessens the anxiety and stress. We believe that alcohol makes us feel better. But an addiction cycle is actually taking place because we find ourselves on this roller coaster ride. Until you look at this entire cycle consciously, it's difficult to see what's actually happening on a chemical level. Alcohol is addictive because you wind up worse off after every drink. And you mistakenly believe that another drink will bring you back up. It's the problem and the solution at the same time. It's the chicken and the egg. It's a cycle, and you can break it if you choose. What happens when you allow the cycle to continue? You build up a tolerance to the poison. Tolerance is your body's way of protecting itself in any way it can. Your body is smart, and it learns. And it prepares to fight the battle ahead. If you normally drink 4 glasses of wine a night, your body has learned that, and your brain measures out the necessary counter chemicals for a normal night of drinking. So if you decide you're going to just have one, your body has already unleashed the countermeasures for much more than that, which means you don't get the same effect from one glass. You need more to get the same numbing effect. Sometimes it takes 4 or 5 glasses before you even feel it. Because guess what? Your body anticipated those 4 glasses and gave you exactly what it needed to stay in homeostasis. It outsmarted you, and over time, you're going to need more and more alcohol to reach the same levels you used to get with just 1 glass. The dangerous part there, of course, is that the poison builds up. And once you get to a certain percentage of alcohol in your body, the anesthetic kicks in and you pass out, or you die. Detoxing from alcohol is even more toxic. Here's the kicker. In order for your body to process and get rid of alcohol, it has to create the chemical acetaldehyde. The amount of acetaldehyde that is released into your body from just 1 unit of alcohol would never be allowed in any food because it would be deemed as too toxic. And acetaldehyde is actually more toxic than the alcohol itself. So we drink, we build tolerance. To get the same feeling of relief from everyday stress, we need to drink more. And we produce higher and higher levels of acetaldehyde to process the alcohol. And we don't even realize how much poison is circulating in our bodies at any given time. How much is too much? At what point can our bodies no longer keep up? Think about that for a minute. Hangovers, self-loathing, and regret are all unfortunate side effects of too much alcohol. But the chemical reality of drinking is downright terrifying. Once we consciously realize what we're actually putting into our bodies, ethanol and acetaldehyde, we can't go back to blissful ignorance. Now that you know what can happen and why alcohol is addictive, you can't unknow it. By bringing this information into our conscious minds, we can finally see that the benefit we think we're getting from alcohol is actually relieving a symptom that alcohol created to begin with. Today, take a few minutes to write a thank you note to your body. Thank it for taking such good care of you so far. Tell it you understand now. You get it. You know that alcohol is actually a poisonous chemical called ethanol. And you finally get that your body has to produce even more poisonous substance, acetaldehyde, to process and get rid of ethanol. Explain your current understanding of the addiction cycle to your body. Now that you consciously understand what's happening, you get to make a conscious decision about your drinking habits. Day 27, Journal Questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. My new knowledge. Write out the big things you have learned in this lesson about alcohol. What has been surprising? What did you kind of know before and now know for sure? 2. How does this knowledge make me feel? Consider everything you've just written and learned and how it makes you feel. Writing specifically about how you feel helps you both process your feelings around new information and cement the concepts in your mind. Remember as you're writing that all of your feelings are valid. Just allow yourself to become aware of them. Day 27 Reflections from AlcoholExperiment.com. Mike says, "My biggest lesson so far is this. Alcohol is an addictive poison, period. Whether I just have one drink or 10, any amount of alcohol is a poison to my body. Learning this fact has been life-changing for me. I used to believe that since I was a moderate drinker, I was not harming my body by drinking a glass or two of wine daily. Now I know the truth, and I see alcohol for what it is, poison." Georgia says, "Wow, I'm amazed how far I've come. Looking at everything I thought was a problem on day 5, and how many of those things have been resolved or are in the process of being resolved. It is so empowering and inspiring. I'm moving on and moving forward, and if I stick at it, I will be successful. There is hope. There is always hope." Natasha says, "Woke up this morning and felt so good laying there. I looked back on how miserable I used to feel when the alarm went off every day and wondered how I was going to get through the day. Now I feel well rested and ready to start my day. This program is amazing. I'm a little disappointed that it's ending so soon. Off to the gym. Here's to an alcohol-free day." Day 28. The truth about moderation. William Faulkner said, "Don't bother just to be better than others. Try to be better than yourself." We're coming to the end of this experiment, and you're going to have to decide what to do next. Will you stay alcohol-free for another 30 days or 60 days or indefinitely? Or will you decide to carry on as before but become more mindful of your behavior? Before we go any further, I want to congratulate you for making it this far. Whether you sailed through without a single drink or gave in a time or two, you are not the same person you were when you began this experiment. You have new information and you get to make new decisions. I also want to make it clear that this is your decision and there are no wrong answers. And guess what? You get to change your mind anytime you want to. That's your right and your prerogative as a human being. That said, let's talk about moderation for a bit. I do believe moderation is possible. Either alcohol just isn't important to a person because they've not yet developed an emotional or physical addiction and can truly take it or leave it, or they're willing to put in the effort to pay attention and moderate how they drink. This means constant vigilance and regular assessment, and it means being willing to make changes whenever they become necessary. I know a gentleman who drinks 17 units of alcohol every Friday night. He doesn't drink any other night of the week, and he's been doing this without fail since 2002. So yes, it is possible. The power of decision. But there is an incredible power to making a decision. Once you've truly made a decision about something in your whole body and mind, there is no plan B. There's no turning back. And that's a good thing because it lets you escape the maybe trap. Instead of running around in circles your whole life thinking, maybe I'll drink tonight. No, I shouldn't. But sure, I can moderate for a little while. But oh, things seem to be getting out of control. So is it time to cut back again? Let's face it. That's exhausting. When you make a decision that you're not a drinker anymore, that's it. You're free from the hamster wheel. Alcohol no longer has a hold over you because you are of one mind. Your conscious and your subconscious want the same thing. How cool is that? The key for me was changing my perspective from, I don't get to drink, to, I could, but I don't want to. What I personally wanted for myself was for alcohol to become irrelevant in my life, a total non-issue. And that's where my own experience led me. Because I made the decision that I no longer wanted to put that stuff in my body, moderation was no longer even a decision I had to make. Of course, it took a journey to get to that point. But once I got here, I've never looked back. The ins and outs of moderation are complex, both physically and psychologically. So before you make a decision to moderate, consider these ideas. First, moderation means you're always making decisions. What should I drink? How much is too much? Should I have this next drink? Research shows that any decision, small or large, takes energy. Decisions make you tired, which in turn makes you grumpy and exhausted. And if you thought moderation was tough when you're in a good mood, when you're tired and cranky from the effort of moderation, it becomes next to impossible. Making one big decision with all your mind, body, and spirit liberates you from the hundreds of daily decisions around alcohol that sap your energy. Second, moderation doesn't make sense from a psychological perspective. Alcohol creates a thirst for itself. We've already covered how this substance is neurochemically addictive. It artificially stimulates the pleasure center in your brain, and you release counterchemicals to depress that stimulation. As the alcohol leaves your system, your mood plunges further than it was before you started drinking. And you naturally want more.